From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a small number of fully vaccinated people are still getting sick from COVID. Health officials say that's not necessarily cause for alarm.
But I think there is kind of this undue confidence that comes with getting the vaccine. It's time to party, and that's just not the case yet.
Also, a conversation with poet Thomas Lynch about his new collection of work and navigating the grief of his daughter's death.
We think by talking about the dead, we are somehow encumbering the bereaved. I find just the opposite.
And a citizen science project helps make data about Michigan's lakes and aquatic wildlife more accessible.
We have data going back to as long as 1893. And this is data including what fish are occurring in which lakes.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, writer Thomas Lynch talks about his years reckoning with death as a funeral director. Those years left him simultaneously prepared and unprepared for the death of someone very close to him last summer. That conversation's coming up later in the hour. But first, we've all heard health officials telling us to keep on wearing those masks and to socially distance even after we get doses of the COVID vaccine. Now we know why. Bridge, Michigan health reporter Robin Erb has just published a story with new data on infections, hospitalizations, and a few deaths among Michiganders who have received COVID vaccines. Robin, welcome back to Stateside.
It's always good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if we could talk broadly first about the surge of COVID cases in Michigan right now. Despite the fact that 1.8 million residents have been vaccinated, we still have an extremely high rate of new infections, right?
We do. It's really, really concerning.
What are health officials saying about why we're in the midst of this additional surge?
You know, we've been asking that question for the last week or so, and we're getting a variety of answers. And I think that's because there is no single answer. You know, it comes down, first of all, to the new variants that are circulating, not only in Michigan, but elsewhere. As you know, they are more transmissible than the coronavirus that was spreading last year. So that's one of the big reasons. We also opened up, school sports. And I think, and I don't know there's data on this, but just generally, I know I see people saying, hey, I've got my vaccine. It's time to meet with my friends. It's time to go to the restaurant. And, I'm not criticizing anybody's judgment for wanting to do those things and do those things safely. But I think there is kind of this confidence, this undue confidence that comes with getting the vaccine. It's time to party. And that's just not the case yet.
No question. So you looked into a couple of hundred cases in which fully vaccinated Michiganders got COVID-19 after receiving both doses. What do we know about this? Were pre-existing conditions present or maybe some other health factors coming into play in these cases?
We don't know that yet. Of the 246 cases let me back up. These are folks who have been fully vaccinated. That means they've had either both doses of the Pfizer or the Moderna, or they've had their Johnson & Johnson one-dose vaccine. We don't know a lot about the 246 cases just yet. The state is trying to find out more about those. But what we do know is, they generally were asymptomatic or only mildly sick people. Now, that said, there were 11 of those cases where folks got hospitalized with COVID even after they were vaccinated.
What do we know about the three cases that resulted in the death of people who were fully vaccinated?
Again, the state is still looking at those. We don't have details on those, quite frankly. But I want to make this point. 246 may sound like a lot of people, but that is of more than 1.8 million people who have been vaccinated. Those are incredibly low, low numbers when you look at the vaccine rate. And it goes to that idea that the vaccines are incredibly effective.
We know that the COVID vaccines are not fully effective in most cases until at least 2 weeks have passed after receiving the full dosage. Do you know if these positive cases among Michiganders who had received vaccines, if they occurred during or after that 2-week period?
It appears that those are after the 14 days. So, you know, keep in mind that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are more than 90% effective, but that still leaves a whole lot of people who aren't able to mount that defense. So even though they have been vaccinated and they're past that 14 days, some of those folks still may be vulnerable to the COVID virus.
I just want to put out there in this moment that there are definitely people who have some caution or some outright skepticism about the COVID vaccines. And they might take this to mean, well, it's just not effective, or maybe it's something that they should steer clear of. What's your take on this? And what have you heard health professionals saying about what we should understand about this?
Sure. There are no guarantees with the vaccine. That's got to be said right up front. There are no guarantees with this vaccine, but we do know they are incredibly effective. And even if you look beyond the state numbers, the local hospitals are looking at the numbers of healthcare workers they've vaccinated and how many of them have been sick. And even those are incredibly low numbers of those who have tested positive for COVID after being vaccinated. And they are just generally not very sick, even if they test positive.
Robin, with your knowledge of the clinical trials in the COVID vaccines, you know, we were seeing numbers like, you know, the Moderna vaccine is maybe 92% effective. For the number of people taking these vaccines right now, do these infection rates among vaccinated Michiganders, does that track with what you would expect given what we were told about the vaccine's effectiveness?
It does track. I don't think they should be a surprise at all. Again, when you were talking about 1.8 million Michiganders being vaccinated, 246 with breakthrough infections shouldn't be a surprise. The other thing to look at is when we're looking at the present surge in cases, that the hospitalizations we're looking at are younger people, the younger unvaccinated people. If you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, we were talking about a lot of older people and a lot of older people dying from COVID. And that surge is not happening at such great rates among that age group right now.
Right.
They seem
right.
to be much more protected than the rest of us who are not vaccinated.
Can you tell if the vaccine manufacturer had any impact on these outcomes? Was there any trend of those who received Moderna or Pfizer having a different set of numbers?
We don't know that yet. The state is looking at that. And again, some of the hospital researchers will be looking at that as well. One of the questions, there are a number of questions they're going to ask, including which vaccines did people get? What were the outcomes? What are the demographics of those folks? And even, you know, whether or not those people may have tested positive before the vaccine and then have that lingering positive result after the vaccine. So in short, there is a lot we don't know in this data yet, but we'll keep reporting on it.
That's interesting. Robin, there was a press conference on Friday in which Governor Gretchen Whitmer said no one being treated in Michigan's hospitals for COVID were fully vaccinated. That turned out not to be true. Has Governor Whitmer's office had anything further to say about that discrepancy?
We put in a call to her office and we have not heard back.
There's a system in place called the Michigan Disease Surveillance System. I believe this is how we found out that these cases happened, right?
Right.
How can you tell us about how it works and how long it's been in use?
Sure. I can't give you an exact date, but it's been around for years. And this is the program that tracks communicable diseases within the state. So whether that is, you know, measles or whatnot, local public health officials get those data and then they put it in the MDSS. And that's what generates all these reports every year about, you know, the diseases that are affecting us as Michiganders.
Right. Does Governor Whitmer's office use that system?
That I don't know. I would assume she has access to it, but I'm not sure who in the office actually accesses it. Generally, it's used by public health. So if you go in and your doctor diagnoses you with a communicable disease, that gets transferred to public health, and public health is the major user of the MDSS system.
Robin, there's been so much attention on this. You know, this is a novel virus and a novel set of vaccines. Obviously, these are questions that, as you say, are going to continue to unfold. Are there other questions that you feel are developing that that are on your mind as we look at the effectiveness of the vaccines and just how their use is changing behavior in Michigan?
You know, one of the things I'm really intrigued by is this impact of COVID on younger people. And I'm talking not only 20s and 30 something folks, but kiddos as well. And we are seeing that those hospital age numbers are coming down. And so we're curious, is that a result of the variant? Is it something else at play? But this much is certain, younger people are being affected these days.
Were you able to get any data on the spread of ages in these cases that you were reporting on for the article?
I was not, no.
It's one of those many questions that still remain to be answered. Robin Erb is a health reporter for Bridge, Michigan. Robin, thank you so much. We know that these are developing stories, and we appreciate your telling us what you can.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those doing the math at home, the percentage of fully vaccinated Michiganders who died after receiving their vaccine doses is 0.000167%. Contrast that with the latest reported death rates. On April 5th, the state recorded 23 deaths and 26,281 hospitalizations. Overall, 17,282 people in Michigan have died from this disease. If you're wrestling with questions about the numbers or about the latest surge, you're in good company. We'd like to hear what's on your mind. We'd love it if you'd email us. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or tweet at us. Our handle is @statesideradio. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Thomas Lynch is no stranger to grief. This award-winning poet spent much of his career as the funeral director for Lynch and Sons in the Detroit metro area. That gave him an interesting vantage point for observing the pain and loss of the past year, both his own and that of the broader world. Just a note, this conversation contains a discussion about suicide. It might not be appropriate for some listeners. Thomas Lynch has a new collection of poetry, essays, and more. It's publishing today, and it's called Bone Rosary. He writes in the introduction, "Never in my life did the sky seem to be falling from all four corners as it seems to now. The pandemic, racial injustice, economic collapse, climate change. Nor has the body politic, the culture at large, ever seemed so in cahoots as a comorbidity." Thomas Lynch, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thanks, April. Nice to be here.
Hey, the last time we talked to you, you were sort of hiding out from COVID at a family property up north. Is that where you are right now?
Yes, I haven't stirred from here much at all. So, yeah, it's a gilded quarantine, but quarantine nonetheless. So,
well, we're glad to hear you're keeping safe. Also, since the last time we talked, you lost your daughter, Heather.
Yeah, Heather died last July the 2nd.
We are so sorry to hear about this.
Thank you for your fellow feelings and condolences. We're just doing a day at a time. My family, Heather's mother, Heather's stepmother, Heather's brothers, and me. And, I'm still upright in speaking in sentences, which I count as a real gift, that I haven't been sort of entirely leveled, you know?
Yeah. I think still upright is maybe the most any of us are hoping for in this moment. Heather seems like she had a pretty amazing life. Do you mind telling us a little bit about her?
No, I love to speak about her. She was my only daughter. She was, I think, she had a huge native intelligence, which she pursued through education and experience and the rest. But she was beset, as so many people are, by a malaise that we would call, depression or schizophrenia, which developmentally began to show itself more and more in her adult life. There were inklings of it early in her life, but in all ways, she was beset by this because she had such energy and such commitment to a lot of different causes, and we all learned a lot from her. And but this illness pursued her all of her life, and in the end, it took her from us, and she died by suicide. And in the same way that if I drop dead, as I expect to someday, of a final fatal symptom, it will be of the heart disease or misadventures of related to, you know, my well-being. In the same way, I suppose that suicide is the final fatal symptom of an illness that included a nearly 15-year estrangement from her family of origin. And that was hard on all of us. And it seems odd to say now, April, but it, in some ways it sort of readied us for the horrific death by suicide that we all suffered.
Thomas, it's really hard for some families to speak publicly about deaths by suicide. Why was it important to you to tell people about the manner of her death?
I don't know that it was. I never felt like an urgency, but I just never felt like I'm fairly concerned about privacy issues, but I'm not as fond of secrecy issues. I think they work against our better purposes and our best instincts. So I do know that in 50 years as a funeral director, the thing I feared the most was to walk into a room to sit down with parents who I now feel a closer, hard-won kinship with. And the reason I feared it because I didn't know what to say. No one ever does. And yet I find that if I broach the topic, she had many friends. She had dozens of cousins who loved her dearly and learned from her. And I find that if I signal that this is not a taboo topic for me, it allows so much good remembrance of this beautiful jewel of a human being that we had the good luck to know, not as long as we would have wished to, but longer than many do. So I think the fright that most of us feel around the newly bereaved, and in particular the newly bereaved by suicide, is that we don't know exactly what to say. And we're afraid that any mention of the dead, and this is true regardless of the cause of death, we think by talking about the dead, we are somehow encumbering the bereaved. I find just the opposite, that any conversation about the dead, my daughter, my parents, my neighbors in Clare who died between Christmas and the Epiphany, I'd say that the catalog of losses for most people, certainly people who get to be old farts like me, that catalog is ongoing. And so talk about the dead is by allowing them to have a conversation, it's a kindness to them. So we're always afraid that we might remind the bereaved of the death in the family, as if they could ever forget it. You know, it's front of mind for most people who carry these sadnesses with them. Most of our hearts are broken in one way or the other. And the courage that ordinary people display by being upright and talking in sentences or going to work or taking care of the babies or feeding the hungry or, you know, voting in the primary election, whatever it is, we keep telling ourselves that life goes on, which is, as anyone who has ever suffered a death in the family knows, the good news and the bad news, but it is the news. Life does go on. The world persists with or without us. But my daughter, I remember on her birthday this year, which was the 1st of March, there was this sudden recognition that I was more grateful for the 45 years she was among us, even though some of those years were quieted by mental illness and challenged by mental illness. I treasured those years. I was grateful for those years more than I grieved the by that time 6 or 8 months without her. I hope that remains the case because, in general, I think that gratitude is an easier lift than grievance is. I don't know. I'm just doing a day at a time, April, the same as I've done for a long time because, as certainly anybody in my line of work knows, life changes very quickly, very quickly.
Yeah. If you're just joining us today, my guest is writer Thomas Lynch. His new collection of poems is called Bone Rosary. And so this collection in which it feels like your daughter, it's in part dedicated to her, and it feels permeated by her presence in many ways. This collection of poems and other works kind of explodes on us in a torrent of words. The second poem in the collection is called simply A Death. I was wondering if I could ask you to read it for us.
Well, sure I will. That was actually a poem. I think that might be the first poem I ever published. And I sent it to Poetry Magazine because it sounded like a place for poems. And when John Frederick Nims, The Bed of Heaven to Him, took it, he was from Muskegon, Michigan, which is probably why he looked at the poem in the first place, because the Michigan address on the return envelope. Now that I think about it, this poem was written in response to the death in her 40s of a classmate of mine all through grade school and high school. A death. In the end, you want the clean dimensions of it mentioned. To know the thing adverbially, while asleep, after long illness, tragically, in a blaze, as you would the word of any local weather, where it gathered, when it got here, how it kept the traffic at a standstill, slowed the pace, closed the terminals. Lineage and issue, names and dates, the facts you gain most confidence in facing, histories and habitats and whereabouts. Speak of it if you speak of it at all in parts, the CVA or insufficiency or growth that grew indifferent to prayer and medication. Better a tidy science for a heart that stops than the round and witless horror of someone who one dry night in perfect humor ceases measurably to be.
Does that observation about how we are able to talk about death and process death in pieces and through, I don't know, a certain distance, does that still track for you?
Well, I think talking around the edges, we like to get a toe in the door and then a foot in the door before we walk right into the room where the horrendous vacancy abides. Does that make sense to you, April?
Yeah.
It's like, like, it is a mystery, isn't it? And that's why I must tell you that I've made a life study out of funerals and what's important and what's nonsense and what's, you know, what are the essentials and what are the accessories? What are the fundamental elements of a good funeral and what's just the doodads and, you know, like, and one of the things I've always said is essential to a good funeral is the corpse. The dead guy has to show up. There has to be this confrontation between the living and the dead for the, you know, and actually it is the living getting the dead where they need to go that gets the living where they need to be. It's this funny little commingling of purposes that it results in, I think, good grieving, good mourning. And I can tell you that I have always sensed that. I've seen it in the hundreds and thousands of families that I've served over the years. And I can tell you that getting my daughter home from her death on the other end of the country in California, getting her home to essentially let her go again, to get her into home ground again, was for me the greatest comfort, a real balm and tonic to be able to say I got that done safely and soundly and brought her home, you know, to lay her out among her people and let them weep and share their stories about her and pray and dance and shake a fist in the face of whomever's in charge here. I mean, people do that at funerals, but I think the idea of death is something, but the dead themselves are what we must deal with, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to ask you for one more reading, the poem titled Skating with Heather Grace. Will you share it with us?
This was in my first book of poems, and it was Gordon Lish who chose this as the title poem. And I had learned by then not to fight with anything that Gordon Lish said, and I was very glad of it. I think it might have been a burden in some ways for my daughter to have a poem named after her. And thank you for asking for me to read this.
Sure.
It comes from an experience every parent has of going to the roller rink or the skating rink with their children in grade school and watch how they go around and round in circles. Of course, I spent most of my time trying to count syllables and make rhymes in my brain box while my kids just wanted me to wave and smile, you know. And eventually, mm-hmm. if you watch what's right in front of you, the poems present themselves. Nonetheless, we spend a long time looking at our children's ears when they're trying to tell us something. We should be looking in their eyes and listening closely. But one of the reasons I wanted a book on the shelf years ago was so that my kids would understand my diversions and preoccupations. Skating with Heather Grace. Apart from the apparent values, there are lessons in the circular. Paradigms for history, time in a round world turning, love with another of your species. To watch my only daughter widening her circles is to ease headlong into the traffic of her upbringing. Until nearly four, she screamed at my absence, mourned my going out for any reason, cried at scoldings, agreed to common lies regarding thunder, Christmas, baby teeth. Last year she started school without incident. This year ballet and new math. Soon I think my love will seem entirely deficient. Later there's the hokey pokey and dim lights for the partner's dance. She finds a shaky 9-year-old to skate around in counterclockwise orbits. Laughing. Is it more willingness than balance? Is letting go the thing that keeps her steady? I lean against the sideboard sipping coffee. I keep a smile ready.
If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, reach out and talk to someone with the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. The number is 1-800-273-8255. You can also reach someone to help at suicidepreventionlifeline.org. In a moment, more with poet Thomas Lynch. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue now with poet and retired funeral director Thomas Lynch. His newly published collection of poetry and essays is titled Bone Rosary. His writing explores mortality, ritual, and human connection. He lost his adult daughter last year.
I have to say, it's a little terrifying to hear someone like yourself who's had such a long acquaintance with death and life's tragedies to hear you writing some of the things that come up in this collection.
Was it Yeats that said that any studious mind should only consider sex and death? I remember when I read that, I was about 21, and I thought, well, that's good, because I'm very fond of sex. And the dead were everywhere, being the son of a funeral director, and soon a funeral director myself. So I thought, well, I've got those corners covered, you know. But stick with the subjects we know, and sex and death seem to be, you know, those are, you know, 101 and 102 of our humanity, I dare say.
Yeah. Are there things that are coming up in your writing these days that were not there before?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have found that the indignities of age have about them an underbelly of humor that I never imagined it. Oh, I just thought it was a sadness, but it turns out not to be.
No doubt. I hope I'm not reading too much into this collection, but it feels like there is some reckoning with what your journey has cost you. The time that you took to think things through for writing and the places that took you. Does that journey still feel worth it to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what I would do if I couldn't write down, you know, what's going on, you know, in my internal life. I think that's what makes writers writers. I'm sure it's what makes musicians musicians. They learn to sing their prayers and their lamentations. It is the true for painters, I'm sure. They make sense out of form and color or whatever it happens to be. I can't imagine had I not had access to a form. For me, it's language. And had I not had that, had I not had the certainty that I've had, and I'm grateful for the 30 or 40 years of knowing that if I wrote it, I could probably get it on a shelf in a library someplace. So, you know, I'm a member of a fellowship that claims that the spiritual life is not a theory. You have to live it. And I think we are nearer our spiritual life when we are dipping into our arts, whatever they might be. Then when we're sharing the arts of others, I think that puts us nearer the language, the countervalent language. I was reading a wonderful manuscript yesterday that'll soon be published by Wayne State University Press that uses that trope, countervalent language, and I think art gets us there, gets us into a different lexicon, and I'm grateful for it.
Hey, speaking of our spiritual lives, I wanted to get a word in about the title of this collection. You're a you're Catholic, and there's a really great story in the introduction of this collection that sort of explains the title Bone Rosary. It refers to this rope of bones that you hung for your late lamented companion Bill the dog some years ago. But it was obvious that the choice of words, as always with you, was intentional. For a lot of us, the rosary can indicate penance. It can be a way that we pray for people, but it can also be an invitation to mindfulness, a form of meditation as we say these repeated prayers over and over. Which is it for you?
Well, I'm not sure. We always said the rosary when we were kids in May and again in October. And I always remember watching the nuns in grade school walk around with those long rosaries on their hips and watching the movement of the beads and the chains and thinking, I'd like to get to know her better. But these were all young women, and we were seventh and eighth graders, you know. And but I think prayer, like poetry, partakes of that countervalent language that Fleeta Brown, the wonderful essayist and poet in Traverse City, in her new book, writes about. Her book is called Mortality with Friends, and it's a collection of familiar essays on the topic of age and decrepitude and eventually mortality. But that language that poetry gives us access to, and prayer gives us access to, I think puts us in a better place. The theologian Tom Long, who's a friend of mine, wrote to me and said when he heard about my daughter's death, this pandemic keeps us from doing what we want to do, which is run to where you are and sit in silence before the mysteries. I just can't think of a better way to describe what it has been like for me going on a year maybe, that the comfort of sitting in silence before the mysteries without anybody saying, I need an answer to this, or this must add up to that, or, you know, what's the sum total of that, or the square root of it. Just the mystery itself has, if we look at it, you know, without encumbrance, has in it a kind of balm and comfort to it, a mending, you know. What is it Leonard Cohen sings? Gather all the brokenness and bring it to me now. Yeah.
What form is your faith taking these days?
Well, I think I spend as much time laughing as weeping at the signs of a loving God that I sometimes discern, you know?
Boy, that's a lot of laughing and a lot of weeping.
Yeah, it is. I'm very roomy-eyed, you know. I mean, the right movie, the right soundtrack to a movie will make me sit in the chair and weep until I fall asleep sometimes. But it's not the kind of huff and puff weeping. It's just that slow, I call it roomy-eyed because it starts in the eyes. It always does. And it feels like settling, you know, settling in. You know, it's okay.
Well, Thomas Lynch, we really, really appreciate your being willing to talk to us about this stuff.
It's a little April-like going to the shrink and not getting a bill for it, for people to ask you questions about yourself. So you can send me a bill. It'll be all right.
Okay. Thomas Lynch's latest collection of poetry and nonfiction is called Bone Rosary. Thomas, be well, and we'll be thinking about you and your family.
Thanks so much, April. God bless.
In Michigan, we love our lakes, from the great ones to the small inland ones. Scientists need good record keeping about lake levels and lake wildlife to track the health of these very, very important regional resources. But now, a crowdsourcing effort to digitize lake and fish records is underway, and you can help. Joining us to explain is aquatic ecologist and an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability, Karen Alofs. Karen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
When and how did this push to digitize lake and fish records, when did the idea get off the ground?
Well, it's really a collaborative project, and it started because we really found a confluence of research interests. So myself, I'm interested, as you mentioned, in environmental changes and their impacts on fish communities. Hernan Lopez Fernandez is the curator of fishes at the University of Michigan Museum of Zoology. And Andrea Thomer is from the School of Information and studies data curation, particularly of long-term natural sciences data, and the use of that data in science. And it's really a great example of a long-term, large-scale data set that can be used to understand environmental change.
There have been research stations on Michigan lakes for a really long time. I want to say in some spots for as much as 100 years, right?
That's definitely true. I teach at one of those. The University of Michigan Biological Station has been on the shore of Douglas Lake for more than 100 years.
Yeah. Well, what kind of data has been collected during that time?
We have data going back to as long as 1893. And this is data including what fish are occurring in which lakes and in what abundance, how those fish were captured, what gear was used, how much effort was put forth, what aquatic plants were present in lakes, what the water quality was like in terms of temperature and oxygen and aspects of water chemistry. There's really a vast amount of data in these records that are being digitized.
This pile of information, how are those records, how have they been stored and archived in the past?
So the data that we're working with is stored at the Institute for Fisheries Research, which is a collaborative cooperative between the University of Michigan and the Michigan DNR. And the Institute for Fisheries Research has been around since the 1930s and has a collection of historical records, mostly on 5x7 index cards in a large filing cabinet. And we've scanned more than 40,000 of these index cards from the Institute for Fisheries Research since the beginning of this project.
Why is it that having the information on index cards, why does that limit what you can do with the data and how you can learn from it?
It's really easy in this form to go and look through the records and see what's happening on an individual lake. And we can do this if, you know, there's a problem that's come up or DNR is proposing new management for a lake. But it's much more difficult in this format to do an analysis to look at trends through time, through long periods of time, and over and across the state in thousands of lakes. And having these records digitized will really allow us to do that and to look at change in these lakes in a new way.
Well, what, for example, like what kinds of things can you track over time once you have the data digitized like this?
Yeah, so the focus of our project is to understand how climate change versus other environmental changes, water quality or shoreline disturbance or development, may have impacted fish communities. And we're focusing to start on three different fish species, largemouth bass, which is adapted to warmer waters, walleye, which is adapted to cooler waters, and cisco, which is a threatened species in the state and is adapted to cold waters.
Okay, Karen, I'm on board. I'm ready to help with this effort to help get the data digitized. How do I get started?
So digitizing this data can be done through a crowdsourcing website called Zooniverse. So you just go to zooniverse.org and you look for recently launched projects. And our project is called Angling for Data on Michigan Fishes.
I see what you did there. That's very funny.
Yeah, angling for data.
Yeah, so what we're doing when we use the interface is just we're looking at the image of the scanned card and reading the copy and then entering the copy into the database that you and your colleagues have designed. And I got to say, getting into these records a bit, each one of them is like a little story. Some of them include directions to where the specimens were collected. Like it'll say, Follow 77 to Lavender's Corner. Take the truck trail east for 3 miles, turn right, and follow the road all the way down to the lake. They have descriptions of the soil and the trees in the area and the water and all the different forms of wildlife encountered there, ducks and loons and different fish and other fauna. It's almost like looking at a magical black and white photo in your mind of lake life.
Exactly. It's really enchanting.
How long does one record generally take to transcribe?
So they can take between a minute and 5 minutes or 10 minutes. We have four different workflows launched right now. One of them is capturing age and size data, for example, from bluegill. That one takes a little bit longer because you need to enter all of the size data for each age of fish. But we have some that are a lot shorter.
What do you think? Is this the kind of thing that I could do on my laptop just as I'm hanging out binge-watching something on Netflix?
It's perfect for that. And it's perfect for, you know, these times when we're looking for new things to try and we're stuck at home in many cases. And this really allows us to get outside through the computer in some ways.
Do I get to pick what kind of records I'm going to work on?
You can choose one of, right now we have four different workflows. So one concentrates on capturing really the basic information on the card about when the survey was conducted and what type of survey. One captures the species that were found in each lake. One captures that bluegill growth data that I mentioned earlier. So it's really a choice, and we expect the project to go on for several months.
I saw some cards in the database that are handwritten. Have you run across any that you couldn't quite make out?
Definitely, we have. One of the advantages of Zooniverse is that multiple people will be classifying each card. So if you don't have to worry too much about your impression and whether you might be making a mistake, because we'll look for a consensus between people. And you can always choose to talk and discuss with us on the talk boards what you think might be happening on a card if there's something strange or unreadable, and we'll go back and look at it ourselves as well.
You can just get a second opinion, yeah. And now, did you say there are 40,000 of these records?
Yeah, we've scanned more than 40,000 cards so far, and we have a few more to go. There's a couple of counties that we're still scanning to put up, and then, you know, there are other types of records. And what we really hope is that we're developing a process here that will be usable in the future and on other projects.
And when this project is finished, who will have access to the records?
So the records will be returned to the Michigan DNR in digital databases, and then they'll also be integrated with the database at the University of Michigan Museum of Zoology. And this is a really cool aspect of this project because the museum has specimens from some of these historical lake surveys, so fish specimens that can be used to look at all sorts of new questions about diet or parasites or DNA. And those are the actual fish that were captured in, you know, the 1940s, for example, that are sitting in the museum. And then the final place that our data will go is into a public repository where other researchers can access them in the future.
Karen, in your knowledge, has anything like this been tried in Michigan before on this scale?
Not to my knowledge. The University of Michigan Museum of Zoology published an atlas of the fishes of Michigan. But having the detail of the historical records that we're looking at really hasn't been, these haven't been captured before.
Aquatic ecologist Karen Alofs is an assistant professor at the U of M School for Environment and Sustainability. And again, if you're looking to help out with the project, just go online to Zooniverse. And could you say that incredibly charming name that you guys came up for the project again?
It's called Angling for Data on Michigan Fishes.
Karen, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Thank you, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.